to the Raptor Show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. I'm your host, Alex Wong. So Will Liu is not with us today. Apparently he found a $50 airline ticket to Montreal, and this is his third trip to Montreal in the last 4 months. I'm not sure what's going on. Is he smuggling Montreal bagels back to Toronto? We're going to get the full debrief from Will tomorrow. So joining me on the show today is Sportsnet's new color commentator, Alvin Williams. Alvin, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, good. Thanks for joining me. So I wanted to ask you, Alvin, to start before we talk about your new role and obviously talk a little bit about the Raptors. You know, in all my research for this interview, it kept coming up. You were high school friends with Bradley Cooper. Can you tell me a little bit about this?
He was high school friends with me. I allowed him to be my friend. I was the big dog in high school at that time. No, Brad was a great dude. I actually knew Brad since seventh grade because the school that we went to, Germantown Academy, it was from pre-K to kindergarten. And Brad, when I got there in seventh grade, Brad was already there. So we just, by playing sports, gym class, we just gravitated to one another. But GA was one of those type of schools where everyone would know each other, although it was a big school with so many grades, our class sizes were small. And me, I was the minority in there, just coming from the inner city. And Brad and I were cool. And I just remember his dad taking me to baseball games. My dad ended up getting a job for baseball. And so we just had a connection. But everyone liked Brad. He was just one of those dudes in school that was really nice, generous, polite, you know, respectful. So, you know, just like I said, through sports and just being in school for so long, we just became really, really good friends.
Yeah, were you surprised when obviously he became this huge Hollywood actor? Like, could you see that in him even back then?
No, I actually, you know, our school had theater and it had, you know, so much of the performing arts. And I don't remember him being a part of any of our assemblies, being part of our special shows. We had other people that was constantly in those programs. There was one guy by the name of Brian Klugman, who's also been in Hollywood and deeply embedded in that world. But Brad came out of nowhere for me, and that could have just been me not paying too much attention. But just over time, I just started hearing his name more and more. And the first movie I heard him in was Wedding Crashers. And when I saw that role and saw like he was being a jerk and how he had to play that dude, can't remember his name, I was like, Brad's a really good actor, because he was the furthest person truly from that personality. So yeah, it was a big surprise. And then once he you know reached a level of success that he's reached, that's not a surprise, because I know the type of person and his work ethic and how he goes about his business. So it's a pleasant thing to see his success and everything he's been doing and accomplishing.
Yeah. So have you guys kept in touch like during your NBA career and things like that? You know, I'm sure it's pretty neat for him to kind of see, you know, your journey.
Yeah. Here and there. As of late, we've been talking more and more, just through email or text. Our school, that we have the like 25th year anniversary or reunion and all that stuff, which I missed, but you know, they would FaceTime me and say, where are you? And all those type of things. But, We will keep in touch with one another, because Brad does a lot of things back in the city of Philly. He goes back to the high school a lot and always visits. And whether he has something coming out of premiere, he always invites the school. He does a lot of things in this area that's on the low. So he is back a lot, and he does keep in touch. Yeah, like when I say a pure, genuine person, that's Brad Cooper, like to the core.
Yeah, no, I love the, you know, I mean, obviously his celebrity aside, the thing I love, and, you know, I think you would agree with me, is just that the local connections that you've had, like from growing up, it seems like you've kept those. Like, you know, even, you know, guys like Ketino Mobley and Rasheed Wallace, who I know you were close with and still close with, like those are like lifelong friendships for you.
Yeah, I mean, it is. And, you know, I always attribute that to sport. I met all those guys, other than Brad, through school, but through playing sports. And even Brad, we played sports to a degree. We played on the same like middle school teams and all that type of stuff. So with Kat and Sheed, you know, we've been through so much together, you know, just growing up in Philly, competing against each other, playing with one another. barbecues, graduation. We were all in the same grade. So we had a lot of life-changing and life accomplishments at a young age that we all were a part of. Our families were close, our mothers and fathers and all that type of stuff. So those relationships don't go anywhere. And when you have those authentic people, like we talked about, Brad, Cat is the same, Sheet is the same. Those guys just never change. So the love and the respect and the friendship, that never changes as well. It only enhances and get better. So we've been, especially during these times, during the pandemic and everything, like we've been really, really had opportunities to communicate and connect and just be thankful for everything we have. So that those are my brothers, man.
You mentioned that your dad worked in baseball. What was his role? Because I remember hearing that you actually hated baseball.
Yes, that is. My dad was he worked in the commissioner's office as a part of the security division. So he would, you know, investigate players, investigate scenarios, provide security at different stadiums. So it was different things, whether it was drugs, whether it was, you know, like the hard drugs, steroids, gambling, racism. He always had to do an investigation. So, you know, baseball, you know, they have their moments, which every sport does, where it's attracting a lot of negative attention. So my dad had to do a lot of those things. My dad, by craft, he was an investigator. He was a detective in Philadelphia Police Department prior to becoming security for baseball. So he did a lot of things. He met a lot of people. So my dad, I had a lot of access to baseball. I had a lot of access to hats, bats, or whatever. And that's the one sport I just did not gravitate to. The sport that I had the most access to, that's the sport I didn't gravitate to. So it was funny.
Did you at least collect like every new era hat? This is I'm just projecting. These are the things that I would do if my dad worked in baseball.
You know what? It's crazy because once again, I could get any hat I wanted. And by the time I was 15, I could go to the mall and stuff by myself. I would grab a hat, whether it was a Phillies hat with a P or an Atlanta Braves hat or an Athletic A's hat to wear an A for my name. And my dad would say, what are you doing? Like, why are you going out buying hats? I could get you those hats. But it's just one of those things. I wasn't so proud and so happy that my dad worked for baseball that I just took advantage of it. If it was basketball, oh, it would have been a different story. I would have won every sneaker, every jersey, everything, and I would have asked him for all those things. But baseball, I just never gravitated to. I guess I played when I was 12, and I almost got a chance to hit for, a full cycle, a cycle or whatever. And after that day, I never got a hit for the rest of the season. That was my first game. So I just stayed away from baseball.
So you're a terrible baseball player? Is this something that we can say?
I won't say terrible now. I'm not terrible. I can hit, but if I'm terrible with people that can play baseball. If you can play, you'll say I'm terrible.
No, I love that. Well, you know, you were buying hats too. I read you were buying Air Force Ones too, right? You were buying out any white Air Force Ones that were available growing up.
Oh man, for that era. And that was when I was older, when I had some money in my pocket, like you would go to the mall and white Air Force Ones, white on white Air Force Ones. That was it. White on white Air Force Ones with a throwback jersey and all that stuff. That was the lay, and a white T-shirt that probably was three sizes too big. That was my era. So I would at least get four or five pair if it's there, because the stores were run out of them, because that was the most popular sneak. So any time I could get a chance. But I also had my buddy Rasheed Wallace, who had his own sneaker, and he was the only person in the NBA wearing a high top Air Force Ones with the straps. So he gave me a little access as well, but I would definitely get the white on white Air Force Ones, as many as I could get.
Yeah, I remember, because his Air Force Ones, it had his own logo too, right?
Yeah, had a man doing a turnaround jump shot.
Yeah, that's amazing. It was funny because, like, how do you feel now? Because I'm sure you still probably follow it a little bit. Like the white Air Force Ones, that's like the go-to sneaker now, and they're selling out once again.
Oh man, that was it. It's funny to see it, and it's funny to hear young kids say they're their favorite sneakers of all times and all that. And it's such a plain sneaker. It's a sneaker. At the same time, when we were coming up, if you wear it one or two times, that was it, because you couldn't have too many scuffs on it. You couldn't get the crease. You couldn't get the wrinkles in it. So that's why I would buy four or five at a time, because I knew if we wore them out to a club or out during a day, or you drove in them, you were going to have some type of scuff on them. So you had to have, and they had to be fresh. So that's why the white on whites were the best. And it's cool to hear the young kids still embracing that sneaker since it's so old and so plain.
Yeah, it's funny though, because you mentioned, obviously, and I think it was back in the day for me too, growing up, like having a pair of fresh sneakers was such a big thing. But now, especially with the white Air Force Ones, the go-to look is to have them scuffed and to have them dirty, which again is like another kind of just a different generation, the way they approach it.
It's amazing. I go to some of the stores and you see that the design of the sneakers is a worn out sneaker, whether it's a jean, whether it's a shoe, whatever the case. And it's like, wow, like people are really buying these shoes looking worn out. But that is the look. That's understandably the look. So fashion, style, fashion, you know, I'm more of a style person. Fashion comes and goes. So I like people with their own style, but it is ironic to see that, because if it was a scrape on my sneaker, I had to get a new pair.
No, I love the dedication to that. No, but like speaking of style, one of the things that really stood out to me, especially during the pandemic when Sportsnet was having their basketball broadcast, and obviously you were connecting in from home, and you know, you would have this great setup in the office, but you were always dressed up. That's the one thing that I always noticed. And I was always like, man, why doesn't Elvin just show up at halftime, just like, you know, in sweats or like tech fleece? But you were always dressed up. So take me through the thought process behind that, because I feel like every time I've seen you, whether in person or on air, like you always keep it pretty fresh.
I appreciate it, first of all. But first of all, that's the requirement, you know, working, being on camera, having a jacket and tie. So I couldn't do anything less than that.
That's why you got to come to radio, Elvin. Yeah. You can just wear what you want.
I know. Yeah. I feel that. But I wear sweats like outside. I'm a sweat guy. If I'm in an airport, I like flying comfortably, like sweats. But I do feel comfortable, you know, wearing suits and stuff. But, you know, I had to grow into that when I was young. Wearing a suit and wearing a tie, I wasn't always comfortable with that. It was always like, whether it was Easter or going to church or a big event or something like that. But I like being dressed. I like the feeling. I just like it. So it's something I do take pride in. And my mom and my dad, they're always getting dressed. So my dad was always somebody who got dressed, like on Sundays and stuff like that. So I guess I may get it for them, but I do enjoy dressing up, being a little creative and trying to put things together to make it look good.
Yeah, I've talked to some NBA players before about just draft night, like when they were drafted, and you know, maybe sometimes agents or family or friends would bring them out for you know, to size them up for a suit, you know, and that was like their first time. What was that experience like for you? Like, do you remember the first time that you know, you got a suit? Like, was it draft night or was it another occasion for you?
Well, draft night, I almost didn't get drafted. I was home in my house, so I didn't need to get drafted at all. I wish I got the invite to get drafted that early, but no suit for me. But like I said, when I was a funny story was, we used to always, for Easter, we used to always get dressed up and go to church or go to the Easter meals at my grandmom's house and all that stuff. And I remember I had a white suit from a place, from a mall in our neighborhood. And, you know, I don't know how much the suit cost, but it was a white suit. And I remember coming down the steps and slipping and falling from top to bottom. And I fell, and my white suit was messed up. I had crayon on it. I had marks from the floor on it. And it was just one of those things where when I was a kid, my parents or my mom, like, when, if you would mess up, you would probably get in trouble for messing up. Like, if I spilled something, if I knocked something over, if I broke something, whether it was my fault or not, I would probably be the one to get in trouble. So me falling down the steps and messing up my suit, I was scared to death to even tell my mom. But I had all these crayon marks and these dirt marks on my white suit. And I think that's the memory of me being dressed up. And maybe that's another cause for me not wanting to get dressed up at that early age. But maybe I was like 8 or 9 years old when I probably got a suit or whatever from a store. So that's probably my first memory of having a suit being dressed up.
Yeah, I feel like a white suit with crayon marks, that's like a high-end designer piece today. I feel like they just like, hey, to mess, exactly, with that stuff.
Hey, man, some artists or somebody that's doing all these things. You hear the kid, like you said, the sneakers are scuffed up. Why not the suit? So that was Easter, man. Easter, you had to be fresh. And a white suit, a light color suit in the spring, that was the go-to. So
yeah,
that was my look.
Who kept it the freshest, you know, back when you were playing here in Toronto with the Raptors?
fashion was so different. You know, like I said, it came when Vince was here. That time, early 2000s, it was everything big, like everything. But Charles Oakley was someone who would always wear a suit. He would have his fedora hats. But the older guys, they really did well. But I tell you, Kevin Willis probably was the best. Like Kevin Willis, you know, he would come everything, and he was fit, small waist, and he actually designed his own suits, and then he had his own company. So he was doing his own thing. So Kevin Willis was definitely forward. He was a forward fashion guy. Doug Christie, he was a sharp guy. D Brown, we had a lot of older guys that really knew how to put it together. We learned a lot from them. But the young guys, we were a mess. We would wear triple X t-shirts, baggy jeans, Timberlands, and sneak. So it was a tale of two tapes in a locker room.
Yeah, because this was pre-dress code, right? Because the NBA put in the dress code in around 2005, I want to say.
Yeah, it was pre-dress code. But when you would, if you weren't playing, I think you were required to wear a suit or a jacket or something like that. But when they put the dress code in, when you stepped into the arena, you had to be, you know, dressed. And it's funny because I watch coaches now. The coaches can wear it, they pull over. I don't even think they have to wear suits any longer. So it's just ironic how the dress code is really shifting. And once again, it's everything's changing.
Yeah, I mean, Nick Nurse has his own hat. I say that all the time.
I know about that. That's big. That's big time. That's when you've made it.
Can you imagine if Lenny Wilkins showed up in an LW hat back in the day?
Yeah. Nah, man, I couldn't imagine that. Coach Wilkins, my main man. I couldn't imagine that one.
I want to get to your career for sure, but you know, first of all, congrats on, you know, this new color commentator role. You've obviously been part of the broadcast for years. Did this always feel like a next logical step in terms of something that you wanted to do to be part of the Raptors play-by-play?
I never knew. I was enjoying the in-studio stuff so much, and it was enjoyable because not just what I was doing, it was where I was doing it at. It was in Toronto for the Toronto Raptors, and even working with Sportsnet, like everybody there showed me so much love and so much support, and they helped me and from every aspect. So it was just an enjoyable atmosphere. And it was for a while where even from going back from playing, it was always the best thing was to play and to be a part of people you really enjoyed being around. And that just magnified it, and that just heightened, you know, the interest. And then when I got this opportunity, it was a no-brainer. The only challenge was, you know, being away from the family, getting settled in a different way of life. But now you're back on the road. You're back with the hustle and bustle of, you know, the sports and the pro season and all that stuff. But other than that, it was something that I was looking forward to. And if I did get the opportunity, I was going to be as ready as I could possibly be for it.
Yeah, what's the preparation been like? You know, obviously I've heard you on a few broadcasts with Matt Devlin in the preseason. What's the process been like in terms of developing a chemistry and a rhythm with him?
Oh, that's awesome. I mean, I think I've known Matt for a while now, just from being here, working with Sportsnet in studio stuff, appearances. So I've got a chance to listen to Matt. I got a chance to be at some appearances with Matt, interact with Matt. And it's been awesome. You talk about a true professional. He's been very helpful. He's been guiding me. He's been patient. He's been all of those things. But I've been lucky, you know, even working in the studio with Brad Fay. Got a chance to work with Brad Fay, another professional that, you know, gives me a lot of pointers. Even working with, you know, from when Tim and Sid, you know, I was working with Tim for a bit, you know, for the in college during the college tournaments. So he's been helping me so much. So I've had so much guidance. So working with Matty D is just another extension of the support that I've been getting. Preparation has been great. It's like kind of like coaching. You know, it's like playing again. You got to observe the players. You got to follow the trends. You got to do your research. You got to do all of these things to put you right back in the game. And not just from the aspect of playing, but just observing. And you got to put all of those things together. So as challenging as it is, it's enjoyable because it puts you back in another frame of my mind when it comes to being ready to perform.
Yeah, you know, super excited to hear you and Matt on the broadcast this year. You know, I want to take a trip down memory lane a little with you, Alvin. You talked about you know, draft night, you know, taken by the Portland Trailblazers, and, you know, obviously you're traded to Toronto, you know, during your rookie season. Actually, we can start at All-Star Weekend that weekend in 1998. So All-Star Weekend was at Madison Square Garden in New York. And if I have my research correct, you were there, right, for the rookie sophomore game?
Yes.
Yeah. So what was that experience like? And, you know, I've asked you this before, but I want our listeners, in case they don't know, please tell the Kobe Bryant freestyle story for us.
Well, that was a great weekend. That was a great weekend. I mean, that year, you know, being drafted 48th and not having many expectations from anyone else other than myself, you know, you had to make the team. You had to make sure you made that 12-15 man roster at the time, and, you know, not playing at first and then getting the opportunity to play about 10-11 games and playing well enough to even get selected to be on the rookie. It was be a part of the All-Star Weekend. The only time I've been a part of an All-Star Weekend, and it was my first year. So it was very cool. And then, you know, Kobe Bryant, I think that was his first time being selected as an All-Star. And I think he was the youngest rookie or youngest player to be selected as a starter. So I bumped into Kobe. Kobe and I go way back. And I bumped into him leaving the hotel, and he was coming in the hotel. And I asked him, I was like, what are you about to do? I call him Young Buck. And I was like, what you about to do, man? And he was like, I'm going upstairs to rap until my voice get hoarse. So I just started laughing. I was like, man, you can't rap. But he had a couple people with him. And he looks at us. It was like a scene out of a movie. He's like, hey, man, he looked at me and said, he said, I can't rap. And then he's like, give me a beat. And one of his friends just started beatboxing out of nowhere. And he just started rapping for like the next 10 minutes, like in my face, like we're doing like a bat, like.
Hello?
Hey, Alvin, you still there?
I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
No, go on.
By the time I look up, it's hundreds of people on New York City streets listening to Kobe Bryant rap in front of my face. So they thought I was going to rap back, but I didn't have any response. I'm just sitting there like, whatever, man. But that was it. It was funny because I had no idea that he rapped. And then after that, I would go, we played Lakers or whatever the following year or whatever. He would always invite me, yo, I'm in the studio. Come to the studio. I'm rapping. Or I'm laying some tracks down. And I'm like, man, this guy, he's tripping. Because I never knew. But he ended up coming out with an album and everything. But that was Kobe Bryant. But that's that weekend. That's that story that weekend. It was pretty funny.
Yeah. So shortly after, you have a career high at that point, 19 points in a game against the Phoenix Suns. And then you get traded to Toronto. Now, not to make both of us feel old, you know, this was the Damon Stoudemire trade, and involved in that trade coming to Toronto with you was Gary Trent's dad, Gary Trent Jr.'s dad, Gary Trent Sr., Kenny Anderson. Well, he was here very briefly, as all Raptors fans know. So you find out about this. It's a whirlwind. You know, the Raptors are trading their franchise point guard, and you're coming here to Toronto. What's that like for you? And this is all happening during the middle of your rookie season.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, at that point, it was my career high, which is another funny story, but against the Phoenix Suns, got the chance to play against one of my idols, Kevin Johnson. Jason Kidd was there. He was their starting point guard, and Steve Nash. So it was no breaks. They had three tough point guards. It was near the end of Kevin Johnson's career, but I had a good game. We won, and my agent called me that night, that next morning, and said, you had your career high yesterday, huh? And I was like, yeah. He said, well, you got traded today. And I had no clue. I had no clue. I knew there was something where, you know, Kenny Anderson, Damon Stoudemire wanted out of Toronto, and they were talking about him coming back home for Kenny Anderson. And they were actually told me that I wouldn't get traded. They didn't want to trade me, but Kenny Anderson was pretty much threatening not to go to Toronto. So I think I was pretty much a throw-in for that short term. At least we would have a point guard. So that's how I ended up thrown in a trade. And then I came back, me and Gary Trent. Of course, Kenny Anderson didn't come. And then they made that trade for Kenny Anderson to bring D. Brown, Chauncey Billups, John Thomas. And I think that was it. I think that's who else came in the trade. So it was something that I had no clue, man. I was told I wasn't going to get traded. I got traded after having a career high. Went straight under the knife for my knee because they said I didn't pass the physical. So I was – and it was my rookie year, so I really had no clue what was going on. I just wanted to get back on the court and play ball. But, you know, I was pleasantly surprised when I did get to Toronto and just get to witness the city and just how things were going here.
Yeah, well, listen, I got lots I still want to ask you about, including Master P, Game 5 against the Knicks. You know, we have to give you the flowers for that, and obviously going to ask you a little bit about this upcoming Raptor season. So I'm your host, Alex Wong. You're listening to The Raptor Show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Alvin Williams. Sportsnet 590 The Fan. I'm your host, Alex Wong, and I'm joined by Alvin Williams. Alvin, the start of the 1999-2000 season. Now, this was a special season. The Raptors make the playoffs for the first time. Master P is invited to training camp. Tell me, I mean, did you guys have one-on-one battles? Because I assume he was a point guard as well, right?
No, we didn't have any one-on-one battles. He played, practiced. I will say with P, he was in shape. You could tell he took it very, very serious, and he was trying to truly make the team. Not to say he should have tried anything less, but, you know, having someone that had that level of success in another profession, for him to be dedicated and the way he came every day to compete and perform, that was something that was opening. There's no reason. It's no wonder why you see his success level in the music industry and then in the business. So he had that work ethic, but just skill wise and talent wise, it was just one of those things where, you know, you're playing against a lot of good players. And I felt like I was one of those good players, and I was the low man on the totem pole. So just wasn't enough spots for him to make the team at that time.
Yeah. You know, that season, you know, the Raptors make the playoffs, play the Knicks in the first round and get swept. And I was looking at the stats the other day. So you, at that time, you were barely getting off the bench. I think you played, Basketball Reference says you played 1 minute in that playoff series. Well, what do you remember about just that playoff series in general?
I played 4.5 seconds.
Yeah.
They just put it to a minute. The coach put me in game 3 and had 4.5 seconds. And that was it. But that was, you know, that was a difficult time for me. Because it was a lot of uncertainty. I've been on teams, I've been in college where the playing time wasn't the greatest. Like I said, I started the NBA and not getting much playing time at all. But, you know, coming back to Toronto, I decided to sign back with Toronto after my rookie year. And I just thought it would be a better experience. But that's what it was. I learned a lot, though. And I was playing with good players, too. You know, Muggsy and D. Brown and Tracy was there, Vince was there, Doug Christie. So we had a lot of guards. And if my game wasn't at the top of his game, then, you know, I could easily be replaced. And that's what ended up happening. I ended up just playing behind a lot of those guys. And it was very similar to today's game. We had a lot of players at that guard position that could play multiple positions. They could guard multiple positions as well. So it was one of those situations where I had to sit and wait my turn. And that's what I ended up doing.
Yeah, you know, during that period you mentioned, obviously it was difficult. You know, you're a skilled player. You know, there's a lot of pride involved. You want to be on the court. It's a pretty veteran-heavy team. Like, were there guys, you mentioned guys like Muggsy and D. Brown, were there guys who you would kind of go to as a resource to just talk to, you know, on days or on nights when you just weren't getting off the bench and playing?
All the time. And there were days where I didn't even have to go. They would come talk to me. I mean, I can honestly say when I talk to my friends and family and other teammates, like those moments, although I was not playing, they were some of the most valuable moments in my life, and not just career, but life, because I got an opportunity, first of all, to play with guys that I looked up to, Charles Oakley and Kevin Willis, Antonio. I seen these guys play in the 90s and the 80s, and now I'm in a locker room next to them, and, you know, just I'm soaking in a lot of game. I'm soaking up a lot of knowledge. And those guys, they saw something in me where they would say, let's talk to the young fella. Let's take the young fella out for dinner. Let's go hang out a little bit, take his mind off of things. And then, you know, they would support. So that was something that, you know, I wouldn't trade that for the world. If I was playing 30 minutes a game and not being able to have that advice given to me from those guys, I probably wouldn't trade that for that. because I got so much advice, and things that I tell young kids now, it comes from those experiences. And it's so valuable. So it wasn't a lose-lose. I definitely got a lot of wins from being in that locker room with all of those vets.
For sure. And it all pays off the following season for you. You know, the Raptors got swept in the first round by the Knicks in 3 games. It was best of 5 back then. But the 2000-2001 season, you play in all 82 games. Mark Jackson is traded mid-season, and you become the starting point guard. What can you say, you know, when you look back at that season in terms of the progression of your career? And, you know, that was a year or two, you know, if I have it correct, that was when Lenny Wilkins came in too, right?
Yep, that's exactly. So many things just fell in line. You know, it just, it reminded me a lot of my sophomore year in college, not playing as much, getting an opportunity to play. Someone got hurt. Very close friend of mine, he was a starting point guard, Jonathan Haynes, he got hurt in college. Then I got my opportunity. And I think it's one of those things where you always prepare, you train even harder, but you do the right things. You don't do anything that could sidetrack you or distract you from doing first and foremost what the team needs you to do at that moment. And then making sure individually you continue to grow. And like I said, that year before, getting all of that knowledge, soaking that knowledge up, gaining confidence, it just got me ready for the next year. And then, you know, you mentioned we traded for Mark Jackson, and he was another guy. So when D. Brown and those guys left, or a few of those guys left, another veteran guy came in, and I got to play right behind him and play alongside of him. And then on top of that, Lenny Wilkins came, another veteran Hall of Fame player, coach. So I just had so much support around me that when my time came, I just used all of that to the best of my abilities and performed out there. And I got a good opportunity to do so. And we ended up winning. So it was a win-win in that aspect.
Yeah, listen, I was in high school at the time. And that was just a magical season, obviously, with Vince Carter, but with everyone else, including yourself, and getting back to the playoffs and going up against the Knicks again. And this time, you're playing all the minutes. So Game 5. At Madison Square Garden, you play 44 minutes. What do you just remember about walking into the arena that day for this series-deciding game?
Man, I don't know exactly what I remember from Game 5. I do remember, you know, having some friends actually outside that I had left them tickets, and they didn't get the tickets. So one of the security people from the Garden actually got me before I was about to go on the court and say, do you have friends? And they mentioned their names. They're outside. They don't have any tickets. So I was like, man, it's too late. I can't do anything. I'm about to go play. And they actually ended up giving them tickets like on a media row. So I was like, wow, I must have made it. They got me some tickets and I didn't even ask for it. So that was cool. And then I just remember the embrace, how we embraced after we won that game. That game, it was like a relief. But if you ever saw the video, I remember hugging Vince. I remember hugging Coach Wilkins. I remember hugging, like, and those hugs were like, I never had a hug like that with a teammate in my life. And I just remember that feeling. It was a great feeling. We got a chance to win on the road. And that was a dope time, man. That was a dope time because everyone finally got a chance. And we actually won. That was the first time us winning a playoff series. So it was really cool.
Yeah, and you know, I have to ask you about the play, and I'm sure you remember this. You guys are up 4. It's 87-83 with under a minute left in that game. And you guys had a double-digit lead going into the fourth quarter. The Knicks had come back a little bit, and I know Antonio Davis had a couple of huge baskets, but on this possession, you remember you slip and fall? You had the ball, you slipped a little. Vince picks up the ball. He gets doubled. He finds you, and you hit this jumper right inside the three-point arc to basically clinch the game. It's 89-83. What do you remember about that specific moment?
Exactly what you said, man. I remember having a ball in my hand, slipping and falling. Everything was going right. And at one moment, everything was going to go I can't even curse, but everything was going to go in that direction. And I was like, oh my God. I'll tell you this. It's so funny. It's a fine line between like success and failure and how you look at it. Because if I would have fell, turned that ball over, and they went down there and got a basket, and now it's a one-point game or one possession game, it could be a totally different outcome where people, for whatever reason, say I hit the game winner, which was not the game winner. But I could have been the person that turned the ball over for game and might have been booed out of Toronto in that position, in that particular moment. So I'm thankful that Vince was, you know, reactive and he was still on guard. And that was a big time play, him getting that loose ball, getting out of his hands back to me before the shot clock ran down and just making that shot. And that shot is pretty much easier to make when you don't have anything else to do but shoot it. You don't have to think. You don't have to react. You just shoot it. And those are sometimes the easiest shots. So it was just one of those moments, man. Once again, the time was right. Everything fell in line for us. And it was our time. It was our time. And I just benefited from it. And we benefited from it, thank God.
Yeah, and then it's, you know, congrats, Alvin. You know, great game, and now you get to guard Allen Iverson for 2 weeks. You know, you guys go to the second round, and you told me this a few years ago. You know, obviously Vince and AI had huge games in that series, and Iverson had 54 in game two. You told me after game two, you just turned off your phone. Like you just didn't need any of the outside noise.
Yeah, I turned it off. I would talk to my sister to let her know that everything was straight, but she knew that my phone was off. But yeah, I cut off all my friends. I cut off, because you know, I'm from Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. So I'm knowing when my friends call me, they're Sixers fan at heart. They don't really care about what I'm doing, man. They want the Sixers to win. They want to party. They want to hang out. They love the AI. So I felt that energy. So I didn't want to talk to anyone. I really didn't want to talk to anyone. I just locked in. And that was one of those times. It was the intensity, and once again, this is only the second round. The intensity that was there, it was something where you didn't have any time or any room for distractions, but other than doing what you needed to do. And I just wanted to commit to that, which wasn't hard, but that was one of the moments. I cut off my phone, put my head during the videos, worked out, and got ready for each game. So It was a good moment. It was a good moment that really tests you as an individual.
Yeah, and you told me too, you and Aaron McKee would just shake your head at each other because he's guarding Vince and you're guarding AI. And like, what can the two of you do? Those are like two of the best scorers in the world.
Yeah, man. And Aaron, you know, we grew up together in Philadelphia, so we knew each other. And Aaron was one of those dudes. He got sixth man of the year that year. He was a great defender, strong guy, all of those things. So I told you the story. I remember just after AI had 54 in game two or whatever he did, game two, he saw me in the back and I was pissed. And he was just, he's like, man, don't worry about it. Once he gets rolling like that, there's nothing you can do. And then just ironically, man, the next game we played and Vince had 50 and I saw him. And I was like, hey, man, don't worry about it. Once he get rolling like that, there's nothing you can do. It was just one of those things where we would see each other like, man, we guarding some unbelievable players. And that's what it was. But it was humor in that side too.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously everybody knows how that series turned out and how the rest of, you know, Vince's time here turned out. You know, being part of that team, and I know injuries stopped your career short as well. When you think about that team and the makeup of that team, obviously with Vince as a star and you as the starting point guard and all the vets that were on that team, do you feel like if things had fallen right, or even if that year, if that game seven shot goes in, that was a team capable of winning a championship?
It would have been very, very tough because, mm-hmm. you know, once again, you would have to go through, before you got to the Lakers, you had to go through Milwaukee, who mm-hmm. was very tough with Sam Cassell, Tim Thomas, Big Dog, Glenn Robinson, those guys like, you know, Ray Allen. Like, that was a very tough team. Although we played well against all those teams that year. We made a trade that season where we got rid of, well, didn't get rid of, we traded. And Kevin Willis, one of my favorite teammates of all time. But we got, you know, Jerome Williams, and we got Keon Clark, and we got Chris Childs. That team, with that lineup, it made us more versatile. It made us more athletic. We just became a better team all around. And we gave a lot of those teams trouble. Even if you look at that New York series, when we just adjusted a little bit and played Jerome Williams because they went small and played Glenn Rice at the four. And then we had a chance to play Jerome Williams at the four, and he just did a great job defensively. So a lot of people could step up, and our team just became that much better. So we definitely had the tools and had the pieces to get to the finals. But when you go out and get somebody like Kobe and Shaq, you got to do a little bit more than just, you know. So although I would never say we would lose, but it would have been a tough challenge, of course. But we were prepared for it. But it just wasn't our time. It just wasn't our time at that moment.
Yeah, I just wanted you to say, Alvin, yes, we would have won it all. Because that's what I always believed. But Anyways.
Hey, guess what? Ask me the question one more time. Yes, we would have won it all.
All right, put that on a quote graphic, Sportsnet. Let's get the aggregators on that. So I want to jump to present time. Obviously, you mentioned you're from Philadelphia, and I know you're familiar with the fans there. What are your thoughts when you're watching this Ben Simmons saga unfold right now in Philadelphia? Obviously, for people listening, I'm sure they know that, you know, Ben Simmons has requested a trade, but he has shown up to training camp and is expected potentially this week to play when the Sixers open their season. Do you think this is a situation, and given how the fans have been towards him, that this is something that they can still salvage in Philadelphia?
You never know. You can always, knowing the fans, I think it's all about the individual. The fans are going to be the fans. You can't control them, especially the Philadelphia fans. They're notorious for being aggressive. They're notorious for expressing themselves in any form, negatively or positively or whatever, whether it's the home team or the away team. But it's going to be up to Ben. It's going to be up to Ben and how he receives things, how he moves forward as a professional, and then as a man. So it's all going to be him. Like he caused this situation from just his reaction. Now, what happened internally, where, you know, it drove him to get to that point, whatever it is, he came out publicly saying what he said. So that's going to make the Philadelphia fans feel rejected. That's going to make them feel, you know, less than, and they're not going to stand for that. It's just that attitude in Philly. So you can salvage it, even if he comes and play like an MVP candidate or play like the player he can play with improvements that we all know that he can make. It's still going to be hard, but I think he's definitely capable of being somebody that can still continue his career. Not sure if it's going to be in Philly, but he definitely has to get better. He definitely has to take responsibility, and he just has to take ownership of where he is right now.
Yeah. You know, speaking of guys from Philly, and another connection you have obviously with Kyle Lowry, you know, when you look at the team that he joined in Miami and you look at the Eastern Conference right now, you know, where do you see Miami ranking in terms of being a legitimate contender in the Eastern Conference this season?
I see them being definitely legitimate, because more so than the talent, like Jimmy, with Kyle being there, you can have Jimmy Butler back to his natural role. Before, I feel Jimmy had a lot of responsibility being a facilitator, being the scorer, being the leader, being the emotional guy, being all of those guys. And with Kyle Lowry, you have somebody right next to him that can help you from the leadership standpoint, that can echo what you're doing and continue what that culture is down there, you know, as far as what Jimmy Butler is a part of and those younger guys are. But I still think they have to get some size. I feel like they still, Bam Adebayo, I think you saw in the championship a few years back, where he was just small. He was very small, talented as he is. He was getting beat up a little bit. So I feel like they do have good players. They're going to have that work ethic. You're going to have to beat them. They're not going to beat themselves. And you got to go in every night ready to go to war against that type of team with Jimmy Butler and Kyle Lowry. And then you have PJ Tucker. You have those pieces. And I think that's going to be the struggle for other teams. But I think for the most part, Miami will be competitive, and they are legitimate. But I'm not sure if they have exactly enough to be a finals contender.
In terms of replacing Kyle here in Toronto, I think a lot of the conversation has revolved around two things, both replacing Kyle on the court, obviously, but also off the court in the locker room from a leadership standpoint. Of the two, in terms of on court and off court, which one do you feel like will be harder for the Raptors to replace this season now that Kyle's gone?
On the court. I think just on the court, having someone like Kyle, that what he brings from the scoring aspect, from the point guard aspect, from the toughness aspect, and just the respect, the experience. Like, Kyle just had it all, you know, and that's going to be the toughest thing to replace. And even if you do replace it with a Fred VanVleet, right, very good player. He has all the things that I mentioned with Kyle, the toughness, the scoring, the assisting, the leading. He has that. But now you don't have two people like that, right? Before, you had Kyle and Fred. But now it's Fred, and who's going to be that other person? And it can come in groups. It can come in bunches. It can come collectively. It doesn't have to be that one person. And I think that's the biggest thing. I feel OG is going to have a monster year. Pascal, when he gets all the way back, he's going to be much better than he played last year. And we know how talented he is. So I think when it comes down to the Raptors' success, and replacing Kyle, the three people that is going to fall on their shoulders are their best players, and that's Fred, OG, and Pascal.
Yeah, and you know, as a former point guard, I've been so interested to ask you this about Scottie Barnes. You know, obviously, the Raptors have been pushing, you know, this positionless basketball and putting Scottie in different positions on the court, guarding different types of players. But even in preseason, we've been able to see the flashes that he's shown as a playmaker, as a point guard. And we had a caller a few weeks ago call in and ask if the Raptors should actually, you know, go all out and actually make him a full-time point guard to see if he can grow at that position. As someone who obviously excelled at that position, when you look at Scottie Barnes, like, how do you project him as a player, and how do you project him as, you know, what position will he be long-term?
Special. I don't even know what position, as you mentioned, positionless basketball. And the point guard that I grew up on, watching and knowing, that's not the same point guard. This point guard, you know, before, when I was a point guard, I had to make sure this person got the ball. And if this person wasn't feeling good or wasn't confident, try to get him involved, or the person that is rolling, keep them involved. So you had to think the game differently as a point guard. You really truly had to manage the game in a different way, where now it's about creating, playing, and doing things not for yourself, but more so for the system of the team and not other individuals. So he's more than capable of doing those things. But I think where he is now is just something where you want him to be. I don't think he should be pigeonholed at a position. He can do so many things on the court. He's special. And then the thing that I love, he takes a challenge as a young guy. I watched him the game when the preseason game, he's guarding Bradley Beal. He's guarding the other guards. He's guarding top players. And with his ability, those are the things is why he's special. Those are the things why he's drafted number four. And I think that's why the future is bright when you have a Scottie Barnes.
Yeah, for sure. And last question for you, Alvin. You know, as media now, you have to make predictions. So I need to know, the Raptors this season, what do you have for their win total, and where do you think they'll finish in the East?
I mean, that's hard. I'm media, and I'm transitioning, and I don't want to get put in a position like, say, I got Scottie Barnes. Let me just do me. But that's a tough one, man, because they are young, and the people that they're going to rely on are very young, and we've seen how injuries can take a toll. But I will say this: the Raptors, they have the makeup of a team that's going to be very, very dangerous, mm-hmm. and very competitive. Because once again, the head of the snake, Nick Nurse, and his coaching staff, they're very creative, they're courageous, they're not afraid to think outside the box. And from what I've seen from the time Nick Nurse took over as a head coach, the players seem like they believe in what he's saying. I've seen that team go into boxing ones. I've seen that team go into full court press. Things traditionally NBA players and professional athletes do not want to do, they've done it. And they've been able to get back in games. They've always been competitive. So I feel like that aspect is a very underrated aspect with Nick Nurse and what the team has been doing. And now when you have Pascal, Fred, and OG once again, and thinking they're going to continue to improve, they will be a playoff team. Now, how many wins do you need to have to be a playoff team? I'm not quite sure. It could be 30, 37, 38, but they're somewhere in a low 40s, I see, from wins.
Yeah, no, Alvin, you're already a vet, man. Danced around the question, didn't give me a soundbite that we can aggregate and play, you know, in 6 months. So I appreciate it.
There you go. there you go. Yeah, once I get a couple of years under my belt, then I give you a soundbite. I don't want to get fired on week one of the regular season.
No, please don't. I'm trying to do the same, to be honest. Listen, Alvin, I really appreciate you making the time today and, you know, taking a walk down memory lane and all of that. That does it for us for today. You have been listening to The Raptor Show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. We'll be here Monday to Friday from 2 to 3 p.m. Make sure you find The Raptor Show wherever you listen to podcasts and subscribe. All our episodes will be available on your podcast feed. I've been your host, Alex Wong, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.